being a banker for 21 years almost.
That's okay. It's going to fuel you. It's still, I think, fueling me to this day.
Somebody that's a little bit bored should be waiting a long time. So people are just going to have to roll up their sleeves.
Try to make sense of it because there's so much information coming in and you don't know what's relevant and what's not.
The corporate world for 4 years as a CEO.
I'm not interested in having this small probability of losing a whole lot of money.
You need to be surrounded by other smart people.
Got me through the door because it's a pretty small group and it's
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Maura Maya. Welcome to another episode of the Finance Podcast, where I explore the professional journey of individuals who have successfully built careers in the financial industry. This episode is particularly interesting as we will be talking about COVID-19 and its effect on markets and how this will all play out. My guest this week is Neil Constable. He is the head of quantitative research and investments for Fidelity Investments at their Boston office. In his role, Mr. Constable is responsible for leading the quantitative research and investment team within asset management, overseeing quant research for fixed income and equity, as well as Fidelity's advanced data and analytics group. Quantitative Research and Investments is responsible for the management and development of new quantitative strategies and solutions while providing high-quality quantitative support to Fidelity's investment professionals, ensuring they have access to the most relevant data and advanced quantitative analysis. Fidelity Investments, the American multinational financial services corporation, is one of the largest privately held asset managers globally with $4.9 trillion of assets under management and a combined total customer asset value of $6 trillion. Neil Constable's specialties include global quantitative equities and fixed income, developed and emerging markets, asset allocation, equity derivatives, and volatility. Prior to joining Fidelity last year, Mr. Constable spent 13 years at GMO, a firm founded by the renowned value investor Jeremy Grantham, as a partner and head of global equity. Mr. Constable earned a Bachelor of Science from the University of Calgary. He then went on to complete a master's degree in applied mathematics at the University of Cambridge. In addition to receiving his doctorate degree in physics at McGill University, Mr. Constable was an MIT postdoctoral fellow in theoretical and mathematical physics. So please enjoy my conversation with Neil Constable. Hi, Neil. Thank you for being on the podcast here with us today. It is an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Laura. I'm thrilled to be here. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. So I'd like to get right into it. And before we get into understanding your day-to-day role as head of quantitative research and investments at Fidelity, I would like to discuss your story. How does it all start?
Sure. My story in finance, at least, starts after it kind of starts with physics, really. I was originally a physicist. I was a grad student at McGill, actually. And I finished my PhD and decided I was still going to be a physicist. It was the idea of moving to finance wasn't even on the horizon at that point in time. And I ended up in Boston because I had a postdoctoral position at MIT, which frankly was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And MIT is a wonderful, wonderful establishment that I learned a lot from. But I spent 3 years working on an extension of my thesis and work in an area called string theory. And so a lot of math, very theoretical, a lot of mathematics, as well as physics, of course. And at the end of it, I don't know how to describe it other than I fell out of love with what I was doing. Not that I didn't like physics anymore. I still love physics. It was the day-to-day that I wasn't enjoying. And at that point in time, you know, as everyone knows, you've got to love what you're doing. and I wasn't sure what to do. At the risk of overgeneralizing, there's sort of three different places that trained scientists end up going if they're not going to be an academic. And at least at 20, this is 20 years ago, it's broader today, but it was basically software, technology, consulting. So things like McKinsey and BCG and those types of organizations, and the financial industry is a very well-trodden path, especially for physicists. it's hard for me to admit this now, but I wasn't a good enough programmer to go into software. maybe I'm much better now, but then the consulting route just didn't interest me. They do great work and all that, and it wasn't interesting to me. And then finance, as I started looking at it and realized there's not an awful lot of mathematics, a lot of programming, but just not like production level programming, but a lot of programming, a lot of statistics, a lot of empirical research, data driven. I got really interested in it, and that's the path I chose. And sort of 20 years later, here I am. That's how it got started. I mean, there's a lot of stuff between there and now, but here we are.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that with us. So one of the things we've talked about is your academic career and the various degrees, the transitions from one to the other. One thing I'd really like to focus on is your professional journey, your professional career. And maybe if you could talk to us about your experience working for GMO. What was that experience like?
At GMO. Oh, sure. I spent 13 years there. I got the job there in 2006, I think it was, and I stuck around until 2019. That was an amazing experience for many, many reasons. Not least that I got to work with Jeremy Grantham, who's a legend in the industry, and I learned an awful lot from him. But he'd surrounded himself with a lot of certainly quirky, and I mean in a good way, people, but very, very good investors and a great organization. So where do you want to start?
So sorry to interrupt you like this, but I do want to rip up the script here a little bit and deviate from the structure that we had for this conversation and talk about your experience working through the financial crisis. You began working approximately a year, almost two, right before the financial crisis got really heated. How has working through that time period and the experience that you gained from it help you navigate the current health-induced recession in terms of both the mathematics and investment strategies related to asset management?
So, I'll jump in, and I'm going off on a path you don't want me to, rein me back in. But so the financial crisis, I mean, it's funny, you're right, 2008 is now, 13 years ago. It's still seared in my memory. Like yesterday. and part of that was almost certainly that was early in my career. And going through periods like that, I learned an awful lot in an awful hurry, right? One of the things that you realize in a situation like that, and I'll try and keep it from a quantitative data-driven lens, is that when stuff like that happens, the proximate causes of the financial crisis are well written about. A housing bubble in certainly in the U.S. The bubble in all stock markets everywhere in the world, all that kind of thing, loose monetary policy, whatever you want to talk about. But in the moment, right? In the moment, it's profoundly driven by human behavior. It's fear and greed. It's panic. And there are no quant models. There's no calculator you can fire up, a piece of code that you can write that's going to tell you what to do next, right? So case in point, and I've told this story before. We ran a large strategy. One of the large strategies I was lucky enough to be involved with in my early days at GMO. Jeremy and the rest of the firm had actually figured out that and predicted not going to get as bad as it did, but the firm was very well positioned for what happened. And so we had portfolios that were designed to do well in what happened, and these portfolios were doing very, very well indeed. One of them was what's called a hedge fund. It's a long short, so the long stocks and short some other stocks. And when you engage in those types of strategies, you have to work with some of the big bulge bracket banks in New York. I won't name the one in particular here, they're basically they lend you money, and then if so you can short stocks. And what happened is that bank got in a lot of trouble. They're one of the ones, they wasn't Lehman Brothers, but they got in a lot of trouble. But we were doing very, very well. So we were making money. So in effect, they owed us money, right? And they owed us $1 billion. And our portfolio was doing super, super well. Our clients were super, super happy. But the money that was actually owed to our clients' money was sitting at this bank. And we thought they were gonna go bankrupt. And we were on the phone saying, can we have our $1 billion? Granted, there's a lot of money. It's institutional portfolios, of course, not individual investors. But and they're like, well, yeah, we've got it. We'll give it to you, but we'd rather you didn't take it. So do you have it or not have it? And, oh, no, we've got it. Well, we want it. Well, we'd rather you didn't take it. And that, there's no quant model that tells you what to do in that situation. If that bank had gone under, it didn't, as it turns out, but if it had gone under, it didn't matter that we were right. Right? It didn't matter that we'd in fact made money on paper for our clients. Right? If that bank went under and took their money with it, game over, right? We lost, even though we were right. Right. So things like that, the financial crisis makes clear that it's machine behavior. There's other players in the system, and the actions of those other players in the system have a profound impact on what you, on whether you win or lose. Even if you were, you know, it doesn't matter that it's like they say in that case, if you're right or wrong, other players' actions can affect the outcome in ways that you can't possibly predict or certainly not control. So that was the thing in the financial crisis that became clear. Fast forward to today. It was much the same thing, right? You've got these exogenous factors, the virus, the shutdowns, what it meant for the economy, how long it would last, how far it would go, all those types of things. There's no model that can tell you what to do in that situation, right? And I think that's the thing that quants have to get their head around. I don't know if that answers your question, but that those are the similarities for me, even though it was a very different kind of crisis, right?
We've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves, pardon, and what we'll do is we'll get back to the market questions, but I do want to talk about, for the audience that may not know, what is quantitative research and investments? What does your role entail? And what does your day-to-day in that role consist of?
Yeah, so at Fidelity, my title is the head of quant research and investing. I manage an organization of about 80 people and growing, and it covers quantitative researchers, analysts in fixed income, so bonds, money markets, stuff like that, as well as equities, high yield bonds. I also have a team of data scientists that report into me, and then a bunch of, you know, what I would call quantitative developers, people that write a lot of code to collect, process, and organize all the data. And so there's about 80 of us. We have two real mandates. One is for both the equity and the fixed income, the portfolio managers, the people who at Fidelity are making most of the decisions about what to buy and what to sell. One of our jobs is to provide as much really useful, interesting, timely data and analysis to help their investment process, right? So an example would be the Airbnb did an IPO recently. Did they want to participate in the IPO? So my data science team was off scraping the web, finding all sorts of information from credit card receipts that you can get electronically, and painting a picture of what Airbnb had been doing, not just in the US, but globally and country by country, and how that changed through the COVID crisis, and how they're, you know, what kinds of properties were doing well before COVID versus what were doing well after COVID. So that the analysts could get their heads around, well, what is this company worth on a going forward basis? It's not a public company, right, yet, right? It wasn't then. So that kind of thing, getting that kind of real timely information in the hands of the analysts and the portfolio managers. The other mandate we have is, again, is collecting, you know, because we're collecting data. We know lots and lots of stuff that's relevant for stocks and bonds and everything else, is to take that information and package it up and actually run systematic, quantitative, dare I say, black box investment strategies, right? With a lot of machine learning and AI type stuff folded into the mix. And so really it's, again, providing support, data analysis, analytics into the portfolio managers and analysts, but also using that information to run investment strategies. And then Fidelity's clients, depending on who they are, they want one or the other or whatever. So it's driving, in many cases, the investment performance of.
So I want to take this opportunity to segue just for a bit and deviate again and discuss about something you mentioned in terms of analyzing information. Given the current environment, we have seen a roller coaster of events as a result of changes in yields and the impacts that this has had on stocks, the effect most dramatic in tech stocks and as a result, the NASDAQ, as well as something that has recently been growing in trend, which is the meme stock trade. So how do you quantify all of this information that is drastically changing from day to day to best build asset management and portfolio strategies in light of all this market noise?
I'll take a stab at that. That's several sessions to cover all that. But so yields, okay. So, you know, when the pandemic came, right, yields were already very low around the world. They've been very low since the financial crisis. 12 years ago, but they're getting lower and lower. And then COVID comes along and yields just got crushed, right? They crushed by Michigan, they fell a lot. Uh, and And that partly that was because people, you know, yields tend to fall when people think there's a lot of very poor growth potential, but also the governments around the world were flooding the system with money, which and actively buying bonds, which would drive down the yield as well. So it was kind of partly the natural dynamics of the economy, partly engineered by central banks. But the thing with low yields is what that really means is that if I'm lending money to somebody over, say, 10 years, I'm not getting paid very much interest for that loan, right? So the cost of money over a long time is quite low. So how that translates into the stock market is when the cost of money over long periods of time is low, that's really, really good for growth stocks. And let's just pick on Tesla as an example, right? That's a company that is people, you know, you're paying a huge price for it today. And the people who like Tesla think it's worth paying it because at some point in the future, they're going to own the entire automotive industry. That's their bet, or, you know, right? Or something like that. And so you can get paid an awful lot of money tomorrow. But when the cost of capital is low, right, people are willing to take more risk because you're not going to get paid anything over 10 years from bonds. So you may as well put it into something that's going to pay you a big yield out into the future. But all the money from Tesla, all the payback from Tesla is, you know, 20 years from now, right? So the yields are really low. That makes that look like a really attractive trade. When the yield curve steepens as it has done recently, so 10-year bonds, the interest rate's gone more than doubled from its lows, all of a sudden the cost of money is getting higher, right? And that makes the relative trade-off between, you know, because a bond is far safer than Tesla, right, as an investment. and so what makes that trade-off, that calculus I was just walking you through, isn't as obvious anymore. Some people still believe in Tesla, but on the margin, more people say, wait a minute, I'm going to take 1.5% for a 10-year bond with almost certainty versus take the roll the dice on something less certain like Tesla. So on the margin, that causes people to rotate out of stocks like Tesla into either fixed income instruments, or if they want to stay in equities, they want to roll into equity stocks that are for companies that have cash flows that are much more certain in the near term, right? And that's things like cyclicals, right? And so, you know, whether it's mining companies or oil companies or industrials, manufacturing, these are things that have, you know, they're very, very high cost to operate companies typically, but they also generate, you know what kind of cash flows they're going to generate in the next 1 to 3 years, whereas Tesla, you have no idea. So that rotation happens because of the rise of the yield curve. Now, how do you position for that? One of the things you do, I personally consider a good risk management, making sure that you understand how your portfolio is positioned versus interest rates, versus commodity prices, versus different currency movements if you have a global portfolio. And so one of the things I've always done in my career is consistently measure, you know, what is my exposure to a sharp rise in the price of oil, a sharp drop in interest rates or a rise in interest rates. And what I want to make sure is that unless I'm intentionally betting on the price of oil, right? Unless I think that my view is I think the price of oil is going up, I don't want to have an explicit bet in oil in my portfolio. So the way I position for this, as much like any other thing, is always be monitoring what your exposures are to these unintended bets and then taking action ahead of time, right? You don't know why it's going to be bad news if you put that exposure on, but you're taking a risk of getting run over by something you didn't intend to get run over by. Right. If you're going to lose, you want to lose because you're wrong about the things you forecast. You don't want to lose because you were wrong about something you didn't even know you were taking a bet on. And then you asked about the meme stock. So let's just call it GameStop and the other stock. That's actually kind of related to what I was just saying about unintended risks. You've got a bunch of hedge funds out there, and let's leave aside the debate about whether you should short or not short stocks and all that. They were short GameStop, right? But you've got a bunch of hedge funds that decided this company is going to zero. That was their bet. And what they didn't understand, or what they, and you know, this is bad risk management, I think, on their part, right? Because it was always the case that somebody could come and engage in what probably on average over time is a long-term losing proposition, i.e., buying a lot of stock in a failing company, right? But there's no rule that says you can't do it, right? And these hedge funds, it all started, and they just discounted the probability that anybody would ever do such a thing, and they left themselves exposed. And so again, bad risk management, not understanding that you had this like exposed, you know, whatever you want to call it, portion of your portfolio. And the meme stock people either figured that out explicitly or for, you know, they sort of found their way to taking advantage of that. And these hedge funds lost a lot of money. Again, I think that's just bad risk management on their part. The meme stock thing, I think, you know, personally, I don't think that can go on very long because investing in companies that, you know, GameStop's not so different than Blockbuster, right?
So I believe something we talked about prior to getting into our conversation of the interview was the difference between the physics and financial mathematics. So my next question leads me to talk about how complex do the mathematics or financial physics get when generating your investment strategy models? What can the trade-off be of having a more complex model?
So as a general rule, the mathematics and there's not really much physics going on in financial industry, but the mathematics that you would use is not nearly as complex as I would have been using as a practicing physicist. It's a lot of statistics though, a fair amount of things like linear algebra and whatnot, but nothing is as at least highbrow as what you would. I don't mean that necessarily, it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It is what it is. So it's not really as complex in the sense of like really advanced mathematics. But what it is a much more dynamic, much more complicated system you're trying to model, right? So the types of math that we end up using, like I say, a lot of statistics, more and more machine learning and AI type stuff, which is computer science, a lot of linear algebra, but not much beyond that, frankly. Maybe some differential equations if you're pricing options, but nonetheless, it's not that complicated. What is complicated is the system. The system is immensely complicated. The markets are shifting around back and forth, in totally unpredictable ways. Lots of feedback loops and all sorts of things that just don't ever really appear in a lot of the physics problems that you typically would be solving. So to answer your question about what's the difference between physics and finance, it's really, this is going to, some of my colleagues might object to this, but I think of physics as being like roulette and investing being like poker, right? In the following sense, like in physics, in quantum mechanics or something, you have things like the Schrodinger equation, and you can calculate very precisely the probabilities of certain things happening if you do a certain experiment, right? And if you do that experiment a million times, the probabilities that the Schrodinger equation gives you will be almost exactly realized, right? If it says 10% of the time this will happen, 10% of the time this will happen. Just like with a roulette wheel, I know the probability of 26 black, I know the probability of 13 red. Right. And there's not much more to know about that system. Right. The fact that I know the Schrodinger equation, the universe doesn't all of a sudden decide, oh, this guy knows something, I better change the rules. Right. but in investing, that's exactly what happens. Right. Investing is much more like poker. It's very useful to know if you're sitting on a full house. Right. It's very useful to know the probability or estimate the probability that the person sitting across the table from you is going to draw to a straight flush. Right. But just knowing what that probability is very far from a full picture of what's going on or even how to win, right? Other people they could be bluffing, right? Different people can adopt different strategies from one hand to the next. It's very dynamic. You can have someone come and join the table and decide to do something really, really aggressive in the short term that doesn't make sense long term, i.e. buy lots of GameStop, right? And they'll take money from you in the short term, right? And the physics doesn't behave that way. Physics is much more, the technical term is stationary, but the rules don't change. The nature of the system you're trying to model doesn't change over time. Whereas the financial markets are just turbulence left, right, and center. So it's again much, much more complicated, which makes you're usually just best off sticking with simple tools in those situations. Complexity is generally not a good thing. anywhere, right? Like even in physics, right? I mean, I think it was Einstein who said that your theory should be as simple as possible, but no simpler, right? Which is kind of a silly statement, but or Occam's razor is another way of thinking about it, right? The simplest explanation of what you have in front of you is usually the best explanation, and that pertains in the financial markets as well. How complex can it get? I mean, these days with modern machine learning and whatnot, And just the ability to collect massive quantities of data, forget machine learning for a second, just you can collect so much data. You can actually start building up what are called very complicated knowledge graphs, right? You know, it's a very popular thing to do where you collect all the macroeconomic data about currencies, commodities, you know, get things from news sources, from prices from, you know, newspapers in multiple languages, prices from every market around the world, companies' reports, NGO reports, you know, it's all out there. And you can collect all this kind of stuff and you can actually build in your computer, like, you know, networks, how every company in the world is connected to each other. And it, on that each connection is defined by what? Is it a company that ships goods? Like, is it Foxconn shipping stuff to Apple, or is it General Electric shipping stuff to Exxon, or whatever it is, right? Are they connected because they're both being sued by somebody because they, you know, they spilled water and, you know, all over, you know, a poor village in Brazil, right? What's the connection? So you can map out all these different connections, and that is actually very complicated, right? There's a lot of like graph theory, networking theory, and then machine learning used to build these networks up and whatnot. So that can get quite complicated. But at the end of the day, once you understand the connections, it's actually pretty simple, right? You're just trying to figure out like which companies are going to have the best cash flows, and are they priced appropriately for those cash flows? Like, that part stays pretty simple.
So the idea is to filter out the noise from the market.
Yeah, it's a collect as much. Yeah, the complication, it's not complication. It's actually taking an incredibly complicated world that's messy and gross, but we're drowning in data, right? And sifting through that data to put some kind of structure around it that you can then interpret and use to help elucidate, you know, connections that you wouldn't otherwise know about, or get a better handle on how connections that you do know about are evolving through time. That's where the sophisticated modeling comes in.
So fantastic. I do have one final question before we leave the market segment. And at the simplest level, it is about your view on financial markets. Where do you see financial markets going in the next 6 to 12 months? What is your outlook for the markets?
I don't make market calls. No, but that's a very dangerous thing you're asking me. Is the S&P 500 going to be up or down over the next 12 months? I have no idea. And most people who claim they do don't. but what I will say is that we're at a very precarious point in time right now. The yield curve question you asked me earlier is highly relevant. Yield curves can steepen the way they have, the interest rates going up that quickly. Generally speaking, right now at least, I think there's two reasons that could be happening, and they mean very different things for the economy and the markets. One of them, one of the reasons it could be steepening is that we're in the beginnings of a very healthy recovery from the recession we've just gone through, right? There's lots of projects out there that people want to invest in. The cost of money is going up because the demand for money, people want to borrow money and invest in things, and that's going to drive good things in the economy. That's one interpretation of the steepening yield curve, right? Just a strong economy, good, healthy, robust growth. The other interpretation of the steepening yield curve we've just witnessed is that people are scared to death of inflation. Governments have printed too much money, right, to get us through the pandemic, and there's too much money sloshing around out there, and basically currencies are being debased around the world, and we're getting a big bout of inflation and with no growth. Right, we're just stuck in this like and the sort of stagflation type thing. So a lot of people will talk about this stagflation idea that was very prominent in the 1970s, where you had lots and lots of inflation and no growth. That's a very, very bad place to be. And anybody who went through the economy in the 70s will tell you that it was. I was pretty young, but they'll tell you it was not fun. On the other hand, the steepening yield curve could mean a healthy, robust emergence from this pandemic. Both those two scenarios are very different for this very different situation for the stock market. If it is that healthy recovery and, you know, people are investing again, it's driving up interest rates because we're going to have good solid growth in the economy, that's really good for cyclical stocks. Companies are digging stuff out of the ground or manufacturing stuff because we're going to invest in infrastructure and new houses and buildings and whatever it is. That's going to cause a rotation, in my view, out of these like these tech stocks that have been dominating. But in a world of no growth, right, if it's actually stagflation, it's very, very low growth, or the pandemic. Right? We seriously hope not, of course, but you know, the vaccines don't work as we hope, you know, that kind of thing, that you could have some inflation, no growth, and then that we're going to have, you know, back to the bull market for the Teslas and the software companies and all that kind of stuff. So two very different outcomes. Which one is which? Honestly, I don't know. I told you I wasn't going to make a call. I personally, I'm guessing it's actually more of a healthy recovery than anything, but.
Fantastic answer. So on a more personal level, to what skill and or value do you attribute most of your success?
I think, you know, if you're going to connect the threads between me being a scientist and being a quant investor, I think it's some combination of curiosity, skepticism, independent thinking, the kind of things you usually ascribe to scientists. That's a very valuable skill in the markets. Being skeptical of received wisdom, being skeptical of other people's analysis, not because you think you're smarter than they are, but because these things are incredibly nuanced and you have to have the desire, the personality to go dig into the details yourself and figure out exactly why it is the way people say it is, or discover that you disagree. So it's that kind of, like I said, that independent thinking. I think a lot of it's down to competitiveness too. I'm by nature a pretty competitive person, and that's not an unusual trait in science or certainly in the financial markets.
So a little differently, my next question has to do with advice that you can perhaps give to students who are trying to break into the quantitative finance sector of the industry. What advice can you give them as they try to get their foot through the door?
Yeah, so there's some basic prerequisites, right? In quantitative finance in particular, you've got to be very in depth with programming coding. So languages like Python, C++ is very popular. So Python's more popular for a lot of stuff these days. A lot of statistics, some good solid math background, good coding background. Depending on the type of quant investing you want to get involved in, you may need to know a lot of accounting, interestingly. That's more the area I've come through. But if you're doing high frequency trading, it's really more about the programming and the ability of data analysis. Those are the basics. But I think, you know, you've got to learn, I think, to be mentally flexible as well. The very best investors are the types that continuously update their views as they receive new information, and they're willing to change their point of view overnight. Right? You can't get emotionally attached to the positions in your portfolios. There's new information. You know, who said it? I think it was Winston Churchill or something said, if I receive new information, I reserve the right to change my mind or get a much better way of saying it than I do. But you have to have that mentality of being mentally flexible like that, in addition to having all those basic skill sets. And then I would say it's, as with everything these days, it's just lots of networking, right? Talk to people.
Sorry to interrupt you again, but on that topic of networking, what advice can you give to individuals as they try to build these connections, given the inability to have that regular coffee chat, to have that face-to-face communication, that interaction that helps you build networks and potentially helps you get an interview for the job? How can students connect to build that remote network?
It's gotten much harder. I mean, there's just no way around it, right? But I think with modern, in the modern world, things like LinkedIn have become more prevalent for this type of networking. There's lots of online social, it's really popular in Silicon Valley right now, not so much the financial industry, but like things like this Clubhouse app has become so popular. But just remember, for all the students or people earlier in their career that are trying to figure out how to get in, right? Someone like myself, I am continuously trying to find new talent, right? The most important, the biggest and most important thing in my role right now is to find really, really talented people that I can bring into the organization. And so my ability to find those people is also been hampered, right? And so I think there's been a bit of a meeting in the middle, right? Whereas, 2 years ago, Did I check my LinkedIn mail very often? No, right, honestly, right? Now I check it more often than I would have, but it's precisely because I have no other alternatives to looking for this talent. And I think a lot of HR departments, that's not usually the place to go to try and find jobs, although I think ours at Fidelity is very good. But the HR departments have gotten more and more creative as well because of this. But I think it's just be innovative, be creative, don't be afraid to reach out. If someone like me, you know, if you email someone like me or find something that I don't respond to, don't take it personally. just keep going, right? Like, you know, everyone's busy. But I think a certain amount of persistence, that's my biggest advice.
As well, I wanted to ask, what is the single best piece of advice that you can give to individuals as they try to become great financiers?
Become a student of the history of the financial markets. That doesn't sound like a quant advice. I would highly advise people to go read things like there's this 2-volume history of the Rothschild family written by Niall Ferguson. I would highly advise you read a book called Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb. These things, the reason I say that is that the technical skills to do what I do, you can learn in many, many different places. You can be a physicist, you can be an engineer, you can be a computer scientist, whatever it is. Financial markets are their own unique beast. They're created by people, they're run by people, they're driven by human emotions. And the history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And things like you asked me earlier about the financial 2008 versus today, right? What are the similarities and differences? They're not the same, but there's a lot of similarities. They're all about how humans behave throughout them. And so learning the history of the financial markets, whether it's the crash of 29, 1914, 1907, the inflation crisis in the 70s, 1987, the Japanese equity bubble that burst in 1990, whatever it is, right? Learn about those. Everything else is pretty straightforward. That kind of stuff, well, they'll never exactly happen the same way again. When you internalize what drove human behavior around those things, you'll become a much, much better investor. And not because you can cite historical facts, but because you'll actually have a much better understanding of what the possibilities are going forward, how bad it could get, in what ways can it go bad. So that's my longer answer than you're expecting to that question. I can't overemphasize the becoming a student of history enough.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to suggest or mention as we wrap up? Any advice, any final advice for our audience?
Make sure if you're interested in doing finance or quantitative finance or whatever it is, make sure, you know, you have to learn things about yourself as you go through your career. Make sure you're doing what you love, right? It's a very, very, everything, every career has its stresses and whatever. It is a very stressful, high-paced career. People have to, you know, you have to do what you love. That's all I'd say. Just that's probably the most important thing I can offer.
Fantastic. It has been a true pleasure to have you on the podcast here with us today, Neil. Thank you for taking the time. An absolutely wonderful conversation. Perhaps the best today.
Well, I hope it was helpful and I enjoyed it myself.
So that was my conversation with Neil Constable, a truly fantastic conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed it. As you know, this podcast is powered by the McGill Investment Club. Remember to stay safe and stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming up.